But if I think life is just a game, then I am taking from it its the meaning of its acts. I am denigrating the precious nature of the life process. Do you think the man that made the music stand was able to make a more exquisite music stand because he was not attached to making a music stand? Do you think he really got closer to the essence of music standness because he did not remain in subject-object relation to the music stand? That's the issue. Let's say you want to get close to somebody. Do you get closer to them through playing out the love story of Hamlet? Or do you get closer through getting beyond the interpersonal, beyond the subject-object, to the place where both of you are one consciousness? If we can be us here, us, more us, just here and now us, forget where you came from, where you're going, that I'm talking, that you're listening, here we are, just us. And more us, and more us, and more us, and finally, right here on this word, up there, here, huh, here we all are. How much intimacy do you want? I mean, I can feel it. I can be it. You think we'd be any closer if we were all rolling on the floor together? Really? 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 The thing you're seeking, the very thing you're seeking in life, is so within your grasp if you but only know how not to grasp for it. How not to grasp for it. It's already here. It's here. It's here. Right here. Karma Yoga, the yoga of your day-to-day life in such a way that the entire sacred world becomes sacred. It becomes manifest. The profane becomes sacred. Are those words too loaded for you? You've got too many hangovers from religion? If I talk about the spirit, if I talk about sacred, is it too much for you still? Maybe. I mean, we've gone on a bad trip. It's been a hard trip for us. Because it's all been profaned. All the words have been profaned. I mean, when a man who has lost the spirit within stands up and quotes Christ's word about the spirit, all we can say to one another is we can only teach by our very being. That's all we have to say to one another. It's not the words. So imagine you are a child, you've been a child, and you've gone to church or a temple, and what's happened is a vibrational message has come to you that is not in the spirit. All those beautiful words. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, said Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Do you believe that? You know what pure is? I mean, is pure some kind of a hype? God, wow, watch that. Watch that. Here and now is God. This is it. Here and now is the Spirit. When you get into the here and now, when you get outside of your own mind, outside of time, and you enter into what is called cosmic consciousness, that's the Spirit descending into you. That's what this trip is about. Purification is a stumbling block to many people. The course of sadhana that I am pursuing is called Ashtanga Yoga, eight-limbed yoga. That means it has eight components to it. The first two of these components are primarily concerned with purification. First one has five subsections: non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, non-giving or receiving of gifts, and brahmachari or sexual continence. My teacher, a very pure being, and he wrote, told me about ahimsa, non-killing. He said, if you are in no way associated with killing, in your heart, in your mind, then nothing will fear you. Once when we met a snake in the jungle in the Himalayas, he said, don't worry. Snakes know heart. Snakes know heart. And they shall lie down with the wild animals. You ever seen pictures like that? Great artwork. Great artwork. Great artwork. Same way of saying it as a peaceful man lives in a peaceful universe. He said to me, you better not eat anything connected with animals that die violently, because it will fill your body full of all of the chemicals, the vibrations connected with that whole process. And you give off those kinds of vibrations, because all of relationships with the world is vibration. Might as well get used to that. So I don't wear leather. So somebody said, well, you're wearing leather sandals. I said, well, those come from the Gandhi ashram, and those were made from cows that died naturally. The Gandhi ashram, when a cow dies naturally, they call the Gandhi ashram, they send a truck, and they collect the cow, and they make sandals for holy men. Oh. Non-killing is much more subtle than just what you eat or whether you pick up a dagger. Non-killing is a state of consciousness. It is attachment to killing. That's what it's talking about. Remember, renunciation is a state of mind. It is not your external actions. And if you read the Bhagavad Gita, you read about what it means to kill and yet not to be killing. To kill and yet not to be creating new karma. Because you do your act without attachment. It means to have a non-killing mentality, to be a peaceful being. I mean, Albert Schweitzer went around not stepping on ants. Now, all the time, we're always killing viruses and all kinds of things. Every time you scratch yourself, you're killing all kinds of things. I mean, there's no way not to be killing things all the time. It's all dying and being born every second. That's part of the dance. The question is, where is your head about killing? Take stealing. That's an interesting one. Those of you that know the story of Gurdjieff, Georges Gurdjieff, system expounded by the Gurdjieffians and by Uspensky and the search of the miraculous and so on, know that Gurdjieff was a very cute character. And he did a lot of wheeling and dealing, which by a slight change of language could be called stealing. He liberated unwary people from their capital by excruciating cleverness. Now, the problem is it doesn't come clear to you in the method that once you're a realized being, then it's a different game. Until you're a realized being, everything counts, because when you're hustling somebody, you're hustling somebody at the attitudinal level of hustling. And if you're on the spiritual path, you can't afford it. If you want to get straight, if you want to get done with the melodrama, you have got to go through a set of purification processes which are very much like getting the garment to wear to go to the wedding feast so you don't get thrown out. There is a period during which you can't afford to steal, you can't afford to kill, you can't afford to lie. You can't afford to have anything going with other human beings that keeps them in a subject-object relationship to you. That's a tough one. I mean, I dig pot, and I dig hashish, and I dig all kinds of things. And they're all groovy, and I would have them hanging around usually, and I'd take them when I felt like them. That's what I did in the old days. But I can't afford to do that at this point. Not because I don't dig them. People say, well, you're against drugs then. Well, I'm happy to hear that. Do you care to make a statement? Not a chance, baby. I think they're great. They took me a long way. They've shown me many possibilities. I respect and highly respect them as an upaya. And they're as dangerous as any other upaya. You can become a Meshuggah holy man in India as well as you can become an irresponsible LSD taker. But the reason I can't afford them is because I cannot afford a subject-object relationship with anybody at this point. I've got to be able to look everybody in the eye and say, here we are, right now, here we are, it's all straight. Anything in my head you want to know, I'll tell you. I don't know any secrets. And if there's something I have been instructed not to tell you, I will tell you I have been instructed not to tell you. But other than that, it's all straight. Anything in my life you need to know, you can know. There's no secrets. I realized I couldn't keep any closed doors in my head. I couldn't keep any closed rooms in the magic theater. It all had to be available. It all had to be available. Now, I didn't come to that conclusion through my intellect, I want you to know. I mean, granted, you can read in the book of Ashtanga Yoga, it says, don't lie. You say, well, I don't really lie. I mean, I just selectively report. I mean, I'm trying to live in 20th century society, and you've got to use a little discretion. I mean, you don't... The other day I was... Well... The other day I was invited to speak at a hospital near here in their general rounds. And I came in my holy man garb, and it was mostly psychiatrists. And there was psychiatrists there. One psychiatrist was very psychiatristy. I mean, he was like a caricature of a psychiatrist. He sort of sat in front of me with his legs crossed with a little pad and pencil making notes and sort of mm-hmming through my performance. And at the end he said, I have a few questions I'd like to ask, and have you ever been married? And when you were in analysis, was there much anxiety, and what was the cause of the anxiety? Okay, there's like, 60, 80 people sitting there? And this cat lays this on me, and so I look him directly in the eye, and I say, well, the major genesis of my anxieties were, the major one was sexual, and this was my sexual trip. And then I laid out, chapter and verse, all of the nitty-gritty. I just handed him what usually in analysis he would suck out, say, you're hiding something, I know. Just in front of everybody, there it all was. D.H. Lawrence says, man must learn to stand naked and handsome, and I just figured, well, baby, here it comes. He asked me, he's going to get it. He's going to get it. Because I was saying, he brought me his big, you know, box with ribbons on it, and he expected me to say, no, you hold it, you know, no, I, and I could have said, well, I had a number of sexual problems, and left it at that, see. Then he would have had the, see, he would have, yes, well, of course, that explains why you took drugs, and, you know. But I didn't do that. I told him just the things he thought were lurking in there. Sure, baby, here they are. You want them, you take them. And I said to him, you know, I finally decided after being a therapist for 8 years and having gone through 5 years of psychoanalysis that I wasn't going to cure all my neurosis. I would just forget about them. He that is born of the flesh is of the flesh, and he that is born of the spirit is of the spirit. And I'm busy being born of the spirit, and that whole trip concerns he that was born of the flesh. And I'm not going to spend the next 50 years finishing with that trip to get on with this one. I agree to the fact that in the spiritual transformation, something in a man dies and something is born, and I'm perfectly happy that that thing die. We're just going to leave it. I am just as neurotic as I was 5 years ago, except it's irrelevant, because I don't live there anymore. Oh, my God. First thing my teacher ever wrote on his slate, the teacher was silent. My teacher's up there. He was a very beautiful guy. He's a very pure Brahmin. He's a very sattvic man, very pure, good man. The guru is a realized being. He's beyond it all, see? But the teacher is still busy being a good man. He's really good, too. I mean, he is the essence of good man. He is as pure as they come. He's so pure it makes you weep, because you just don't believe such purity is. Anyway, that's one of the things that blew my mind about the villages in India. There really is the possibility that human beings can be so pure. because I had rationalized away. You just need all this sort of deception to make it all work. I've told this story before, but I won't read it. I'll just tell it this time. That, see, when I was a psychologist, I remember this is where we got to in the non-lying trip. I was teaching an introductory course in psychology, and I had 500 students in the class. It was the first course I ever taught. I was 24 or 5, and it really panicked me tremendously. And I was teaching it because I don't think anybody else wanted to teach it. It was Psych 1 is kind of a bad scene. And one of the big professors, I was an acting instructor, than which there is nothing lower. And one of the full professors sent his assistant, his research assistant, around to me, and he said, we would like a number of subjects for an experiment for your class, but it's a stress experiment we're doing, and in order to do this, you must tell the students that they must enroll for this experiment and that what they do in this work will be put on their permanent records. So I said, well, will it be put in their permanent records? He says, of course not. He said, but we'll tell them later. After all, it's for experiment, it's for science. And I said to him, well, look, you may be a research scientist, but I happen to be the instructor in this class, and there is a certain relationship between students and an instructor which allows the students to trust the instructor. And if I get up and start to lie to the students, who are they ever going to believe? I mean, don't you think that relationship is in some way privileged? I mean, shouldn't I be straight with them? Come on now, don't be naive. I said, well, that's the way I'm going to do it. I won't do it. Well, we'll see about that. So the next thing, the full professor came up. Don't worry, he said, I'll take all the responsibility for it. I said, I don't care whether you'll take all the responsibility. It's my course. I'm the instructor, even though I'm an acting instructor, and I make $3,400 a year. That's the way it is. Well, we'll see about this. So the next thing, we were at the chairman of the departments. Chairman of the department said, now, Richard, don't be naive. I mean, this is done every day. They'll know afterwards. This is the only way we can create the stress conditions that are necessary to arouse their anxiety to study their anxiety. Don't you understand? I said, I understand, you're just not going to do it in my course. So already it was now becoming an issue of not only my job, but since it's all done by personal contact, my whole future was like now riding on this whole issue. So finally the chairman of the department said, well, would it be all right if I did it? In other words, the chairman of the department is asking me, is it all right if I come into your course and perjure myself? I said, sure, man, you can do anything you want. That's your trip. As long as all I say to the students is, may I introduce you to the chairman of the department? You can do anything you want. Now, that was a cop-out. That was where I was at in those days. This was 1954. That's the karma I'm still paying off on. That was the world I was living in, the world of sophistication. Before I went to India, I was traveling in the Southwest in a school bus, and we went to an Indian reservation at Hota Villa, Hopi Indians. And I met with the elders, who were all about 100 years old. And they were extraordinarily beautiful men. And one of them was telling me the story of how they were having trouble with the Indian Bureau, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And he said, one of our boys had an accident with one of the cars owned by the Bureau. And the lines on the road showed that the Bureau's car was over the line. But the next day, the police found a liquor bottle in the gutter nearby, and they said it belonged to the boy who was from our reservation. And he said, This man is in his 60s. He's the junior man. He's the spokesman. And he said, the boy said the liquor bottle was not his. The boy speaks truth. Now, I don't know whether I can put into the inflection into my voice to communicate to you that when he said that, there was no doubt in my mind all the way back through his head and the boy's head, that they were living at that moment in a world in which one speaks truth. And suddenly, before my head, having grown up in a family where my father and two brothers are lawyers, you know, write it all down, get it signed, notarized, watch it, don't trust anybody. Suddenly somebody says, and he speaks truth, and that's that. Wow. Just blew my mind. Right here in America. So I feel, well, they're old Indians, you know, and they're dying out. And then I was in the mountains in the Himalayas, and there were the people living with these same values. I mean, I was just too paranoid for the scene. I couldn't handle, I couldn't believe that people could be like this. I mean, they could really be where they're at. They say what they mean. They're really right here. They're right here. You know, we would be driving in a big fancy Land Rover we had in the first part of the trip, and you'd stop to go to the toilet. And suddenly, 100 people would be standing around the Land Rover. It's called instant crowd in India. There's just so many people, and they're not doing anything particular, so they hang out. They're all standing about 4 inches from your nose with huge big eyes, and they're looking right at you. Now you go through, the first thing you go through is your paranoid take. What do they want? Isn't there any privacy? Voyeurists, eh? Why don't they leave me alone? They want money, they want food, what do they want? It's them. Them. They're looking at us just like you look at a flower, like, wow, dig that. They don't want anything. They're just here. They're really here, though. Boy. Ooh, right here. Right here. Right here. And that's scary when you're not here, because it's a pretty strong wind that comes. That's powerful vibrational stuff when you meet here and now people. Really powerful. And they kept peeling away my paranoia like layers of an onion. I mean, a guy would walk from the village like 5-6 miles carrying a beautiful, some fresh mangoes. And he'd give them to me. And I would go through, what can I give him in return? Why did he do that? I mean, he put me up tight because now I got to do something for him. Because I'm in the world of giving and receiving. But he doesn't live in the world of giving and receiving. There are the mangoes, and there's Ram Dass at the temple, and wow, I mean, like, it just all, and I'm, like, walking to the temple carrying the mangoes to give to Ram Dass. He's giving the mangoes to us like we got two bodies and one consciousness. It's like my mouth's going to eat them because I'm doing the spiritual work, and that's my trip, and he's, like, helping my trip because that's his trip. And there's nothing in it for him. He doesn't want me to do anything for him about it. See what non-giving and receiving means. Tonight, before we began, food was brought to me, bread was brought to me, sweets were brought to me. My guru sits in India, and loving women cook all night to bring him food. And he must eat 15 meals a day, I swear. He just sits there all day long, and these women bring him this exotic stuff they cooked for him. And it's made with so much love, and it's so pure, and he's doing their karmic thing by eating the food. See, he's doing a thing with them, like a love thing. And so all day long, he's just talking, and he's, oh. and mouthfuls of, you know, exquisite things are coming into his mouth. He just keeps eating. I couldn't believe it. Passes it all through like Chinese food. But it's not giving and it's not receiving, because there is nobody giving and there's nobody receiving. That's the point. There is nobody speaking here and there is nobody listening. There is Om Mani Padme Hung, and here we all are in Om Mani Padme Hung, and giving and receiving is going on. The Buddha says it's only when you realize there's no doer that you get off the wheel of life and death. First thing that the teacher wrote on the slate, the pure Brahman I got waylaid way back there, he wrote on the slate was, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, meaning liberation. Desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. And the fact of the matter is, if you understand that, you're all finished with the whole business. Take the example of vibrations, or in psychology we would call it how motivation affects perception. Same thing. Most of you are seeing me and each other. There are some beings in this room that see auras when they look at other people. And they also see astral beings who are also present in this room. There are beings in this room who at this moment see astral beings. You don't see them, most of you, because your radio receiver is not tuned in that particular vibrational frequency. Your desires create your universe. There's an example of how your desire to know the world through your senses keeps you limited to a certain vibrational rate and keeps you living at a certain vibrational level. Don't get upset, those are the horses back in the stable. Desire creates the universe. Standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. Pretty weird being in this little village in the Himalayas and watching the Indian boys going to school in one direction and the Indian girls going to school in another direction. And here are all these beautiful chicks in saris, and they're so beautiful. I mean, Indian women are, oh, essence beauty. And the guys are walking down the street talking to each other just like there was nobody coming the other way. Figure, well, they're certainly highly trained. I mean, they're 17 years old. Why aren't 17-year-old men standing on the corner watching all the girls go by? If they were normal, healthy beings, they would be doing that. Because what we call normal, healthy is where our particular heads are at. Freud is not describing what man is. He's describing what man was in Vienna in 1890. And it happens to be in New York City in 1960. Partly through his description. In India, they say Freud suffered from the disease of the heart called passion. We have read so much poetry about passions that we really believe it. I mean, it's gotten so that if you don't lust sufficiently, you go to an analyst. You imagine that? Well, you can imagine that. I mean, if I said that to an Indian audience, they go, ooh. Sorry, wrong audience. I'll try it the other way. I mean, there are 17-year-old people who have never lusted after anybody. Can you imagine that? Pathology. Desire creates the universe. Feed a hungry... Feed a rooster, all these movies we used to show in Psych 1, you feed a rooster enough testosterone, and it starts to make it with blocks of wood. Everything becomes a sexual object to it. You get a rat uptight enough, and everybody becomes its enemy. I used to work in the field of achievement motivation. I used to set up projective tests to measure the need to achieve. And then they found out an interesting thing. They found out that the relation, you use a fantasy test, which you'd score, and you'd get a score for need achievement, and you'd score it to measure how much a person was motivated to achieve. Then you found out you could work it the other way around. And yet, instead of using it as a thermometer, if you could get people to fantasy achieving, they would go out and achieve. So you started in India, they were starting to train people to have fantasies about achievement. Train them to desire. Train a person to have a social desire so that he will look at another person in a competitive way. Because if I look at you in a competitive way, I'll work harder to beat you. Now we have come through a system that we are totally reinforced for by saying, look at all of the technological advantages. Look at all we have because of the model of the universe we have developed, which is based on competition. It's called free enterprise. I once tried to put into the junior high schools in Lexington, Mass, a program, a physical education program, which really was based on my own training in karate. I didn't call it karate because the parents would never have bought that. We call it Eastern physical exercise. And the program involved non-competition. It involved focusing. It involved bringing the mind down to one-pointedness. Because if you're going to break boards, you've got to be able to focus your attention. Complete control of the mind. Completely non-competitive. You realize how alien that is to the whole culture of the school system? Everything is based on interpersonal competition. Because we assume that's what makes man do what he does. And if you didn't do that, as Freud suggests, if you didn't keep the lid on through these techniques, all hell would break loose. That's the illusion. That's the illusion about who we are. That's part of the thing Shakespeare wrote. Shakespeare wrote Freud. And Freud wrote us. Non-lying. Desire creates the universe. Desire is the trap. Non-lying. You only have to lie if you're trying to if you desire something. If I want to impress you, I might lie to you. A person who doesn't live in end gain, one to me is fame and shame. One to me is pleasure and pain. Can you imagine what it must be like to be that kind of a being? That's Om Mani Padme Hung, Om Mani Padme Hung. Because in that place, in Om Mani Padme Hung, no fame, no shame, no loss, no gain, no pleasure, no pain. You just are. It's isness. It's pure isness. Pure isness can also be called pure awareness, pure consciousness, pure love, pure energy. Many evenings we've gone through that equation. Let's say I decide I'm just going to try to go through a purification situation right here in New York City, and I'm married and I have a family and I have a job. Now what do I do? I mean, let's say I'm going to cut out all the nonsense. What am I going to do? I don't want to talk theory anymore. I want to do something. Because I'm a Westerner and we do things. If I just say to you, be, oh, come on, that's very nice, but what do I do? What do I do to be? What do I do to be? First of all, you keep in mind at all times, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. So that means that as you live in your own Hamlet or Othello or whatever, or Midsummer Night's Dream, you just watch your desire create it all. Those of you that have taken psychedelics have been in the situation where you've looked into somebody's face and you felt a certain way about them, and then you suddenly, something happened and you felt a slightly different way about them, and suddenly their face changed. You call it an external hallucination. Well, this is all an external hallucination. Every bit of it. I mean, you don't know who's out here at all, because all you're seeing is what your desires are allowing you to see. And I said to my teacher, who will I lecture to if they want me to lecture? He says, you only ever talk to yourself. You only talk to your own desires. You are my desire. Now, that's a very abstruse one. Yeah, what do you mean I'm your desire? I am me. I am your desire. Who am I? Who am I? Am I... Boy, he's a suave hustler. Oh, he's a real holy man. He's so beautiful. Oh, he's got a big ego. He's a bald guy. He's kind of an intellectual. I can give you everything in your heads about who I am. Every one of them, and they're all true and they're all false. They're all lies and they're all true. Your desires are creating your universe. You can see, I can sit here and watch somebody come in here and there's nothing I can say. I've had this interesting phenomenon. I've been sitting here now for 3 weeks, right? Almost every night there's always somebody here who comes in with their head fixed. They're like a block of concrete. And it reminds me of the parable of the black sheep. The shepherd and the black sheep. Somehow, when I see that block of concrete, I get completely fixated on it. All the rest, I look around and there's all this liquid here and nowness, you see. And instead of just bathing in the sea of liquidity and just getting high out of my head on everybody, this contact high and all this love, I pick on this block of concrete and I cajole and I seduce and I intellectually analyze and I look for the light back in there. The block of concrete sits there like a block of concrete. And I realize, finally, there's nothing I can say. I don't know, he's here because of what? Because he's trying to be intellectually open-minded? His wife brought him, maybe. There's a reason. But the reason is keeping him right, like, I'll come, but I won't enjoy it. I won't listen. Desire creates your universe. Desire creates your... It's the same thing with... My teacher said, If you walk on leather, the whole world is covered with leather. That's pretty far out. If you think on God, he said, the whole world is God.